Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Pleased to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend. And today, one of my favorite topics with three of my favorite people, our book program. We're going to be asking for your calls. We have some recommendations of some great springtime reading. We have two well-established critics and bloggers and an author. I want to welcome a debutante to All Sides Weekend, author Donald Ray Pollack, who his short story collection, Knock 'em Stiff, knocked it out of the park a couple of years ago. He'll be talking with us about that book, his newest projects, and I want to talk to him about his process a little bit. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic and a favorite hereabouts and nationally because we're online now, we're blogging and everywhere, as is Bill Eichenberger, and he has a stack of books, including one the dog ate, apparently. That's what you said. Yes, the dog ate your book, but you still were able to read it, I'm sure, and we'll talk about that as well. We'll have some chat for a while and then welcome your phone calls and your comments if you want to share something that you've been reading that you enjoyed or didn't enjoy. Please feel free to let us know about that. First of all, welcome Donald Ray Pollack.
Hey, thanks for having me, Christopher. Great. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. I was going through a few websites doing some other work, and I was checking the Ohio Arts Council website, and there was your name. I don't know if you know that you're out there yet, but I want to congratulate you. Donald Ray Pollack has received an Individual Excellence Award from the Ohio Arts Council. That's terrific. Congratulations on that.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Knock 'em Stiff, your collection of stories, which came out, I think, 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Attracted a lot of very positive attention, including the Wall Street Journal and journals. The New York Times liked it very much. First of all, I have to ask you about the title.
Well, the title was pretty easy because I grew up in Knock 'em Stiff.
That's a town.
Yeah. And it was sort of a given. You know, I was going to call my first book Knock 'em Stiff if I ever wrote one. And that's pretty much the way that happened.
So basically you followed the great old advice about write about what you know.
Yeah, for me, and I don't think that everybody has to do that, but I don't know if it was, you know, I was older when I started or whatever, but it was just easier for me to write about, you know, the people that I knew about. You know, when I first started out, I tried to write about lawyers and doctors and people in New York City and lapsed Catholics and whatever else, you know, and it just wasn't working for me. And then finally I decided, well, I better bring it a little bit closer to home.
Now, do you remember when you sat down and you actually started writing? And what compelled you to do that?
It was the day after Thanksgiving when I was 45 years old.
My goodness, wow.
And I remember it very well. And it was, as I've said a lot of times, it was probably some sort of midlife crisis thing that compelled me to do it. And I'd been working at a paper mill for, at that time, 27 years. And my dad had retired recently. And I don't know, I just thought, you know, I'd really like to do something else with the rest of my life. And so I...
So in terms of your profession, at least, you completely changed your life.
Yes.
And how's it working out for you?
Well, it's worked out pretty well so far. You know, but it's very different. You know, it's not like going to the factory and, you know, collecting a regular paycheck every week and that sort of thing. There's a lot more pressure.
I'm sure it is.
I guess.
Now, the question always is when you have a first book that's such a success, everybody wants to – I'm sure you're tired of being asked, how about your second book? But here we are, and I'm going to ask you anyway. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a novel, and – I'm hoping that I can send it to my agent. Probably the way things are, going right now, I think probably around the end of May I'll be sending it to him, and then we'll figure out what to do, you know, as far as do we go ahead and submit it to the publisher or not, or should I tweak it a little bit.
Do you want to give us any hints just as to topic? You could be very broad if you want. Is this a novel as opposed to a collection of stories?
Yes, it's a novel, and it's it's pretty much just two stories. One is about a young boy who actually starts out growing up in Knock 'em Stiff, and then leaves and goes to West Virginia due to some You know, his parents pass away. And then the other part of the novel is the story of two serial killers, a husband and wife. And the book is divided up into sections, but anyway, I've managed to work it out where everything comes together in the end. And that's probably about all I want to say.
Say no more. That's right. We'll look forward to it. Let's be selling some books at this time next year. So thank you very much for that.
Christopher, am I allowed to ask a
question
of Donald?
Yes, please do. Yes.
Well, my first question would be, you're not writing what you know when you're talking about the two serial killers, right?
No. I had to do some research on that. And, but I read some books that actually gave me some nightmares,
The thing I really liked about Knock 'Em Stiff is that as realistic as it is, it's also fantastical. So you're writing what you know, and yet you're taking it somewhere else. How does that process work? That's where I think – I mean, anyone can write a memoir about where they grew up, but how do you – what's the transition from writing what you know into like the stories in Knock 'Em Stiff?
I don't know. I mean, I really can't explain the process
right,
too well.
Right.
I mean, it's like with the two serial killers in the book I'm working on now. In the end, I decided I couldn't really explain why they do what they do.
Uh-huh.
They just do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that got me away from a lot of the psychological, you know, BS and whatever. That's how I, you know, have approached this one anyway.
Go ahead, Cassie.
I was going to say there are two elements of it. When you say that you didn't get into the psychology of what makes them tick, there are some novels where that works brilliantly. The reader doesn't expect or need to know the psychology because of the way that everything falls together. There are other novels, though, that you need that psychology of what makes them tick. And so that's what comes to mind when
I think that's a special talent too, to be able to do that and not delve it to really to create something that might seem two-dimensional but really isn't.
Well, they have to make sense on the page.
Right.
And what
they
do and their choices that they make have to resonate as real to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And that does take a special talent too, because of the questions that will be going on in the reader's mind.
Right. And I think with me anyway, it seems like from the true life crime accounts that I read, you know, I mean, there's always some, you know, it was a bad childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
his mom,
you know,
beat
something
him.
Something like
yeah.
that. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to try to avoid that as much as I could. I mean, there are hints of mm-hmm. what, you know, calls these people to be what they are, but I don't delve into it very deeply.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons it comes to mind for me is because I read a disturbing book this about a week ago, and the author is brilliant in character behavior or in human behavior, and very understated in the way that she expresses it. But it's because of that that you can read the book. And also she has compassion for her characters. And they're not victims.
Right. As we were all talking before, we were teasing about how this is going to be walking into summertime reading and something light and something. And none of us have been reading very light things. And I don't know how much of a yuck fest today's show is going to be. So we'll do our best. For example, Bill Eichenberger, the book The Dog Ate is a book that we talked about last month by Hans Falada called Every Man Dies Alone. And since that conversation, I have read that book. And now as an antidote, I'm going to say it out here. I'm going to admit it. I'm reading Kitty Kelly's Oprah book because you have to. You have to read something completely the polar opposite from that. So, Bill, you've read this Falada book since we talked last. What's your impression? I mean, the dog apparently
you liked know. It as well.
Yeah, well.
Although had a hard time, I think the dog had a hard time digesting.
Indeed,
but it's actually immediately became one of my favorite books that I've read, not just in a long time, maybe ever. And it's absolutely an astounding work. He told, after he'd written it, he told a friend in a letter, I think I've written, not I think, but I have written a truly great book. And it really is a truly great book. I think when an author can say that in all confidence that he knows what he's talking about.
This was a very tortured author. I should make the point, the book is about 65 years old.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, well, the short biography of Hans Vlott at the end of the book begins by describing a duel that he staged with a fellow student. They both had difficulties in coming to terms with their sexuality, and they wanted to – basically it was a suicide pact. Only Hans Vlott is shot, went home and killed his friend, whereas he was only severely wounded by his friend's shot. Or maybe not even hit and then had to shot himself. I can't remember the details.
And he went into drugs and depression that he never recovered from. Yeah.
But he became a writer, and he wrote a series of books, that much lesser works from what I can tell. I guess there's one or two other books that might be.
There's one from the 30s that was made into a Hollywood movie with Gary Cooper. I'm reading it now.
A Wolf Among Wolves?
Or? No, it's the other title. One. It's on my table. I'm not reading it.
It's the one about the depression maybe?
It was published in – he lived to see this published in 1934. And it was made into a movie, and
he was a very popular author in Germany. He was, what you would call almost like a pop author. And it's the war that came in and interrupted that.
Right. Yeah, he fell in and out of popularity with the Nazi Party. And one of the things that his biographer says, and I think it's why it could be a great book, is that he was neither a resistance fighter nor a hardcore Nazi Party member. So he kind of is at a remove to tell this story, and he talks about what it's like to live. It's the story of a couple whose son dies during the invasion of France, and they become disillusioned with the Nazis and begin a campaign of placing anti-Nazi postcards, handwritten postcards, in buildings that are heavily trafficked.
All through Berlin during the war. Yeah,
during the war. And the Gestapo becomes curious about what he calls him, the hobgoblin, and the detective who's trying to – the detective who's a very sympathetic character. You don't want him to solve the case, but you understand that
he – I don't know how sympathetic, but that's okay. All right.
Well, I mean, if you compare him to his boss, who's a complete psychopath.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing that's amazing to me is this complete world that he creates from the ground up, and where everything that happens in the book is either interconnected or at least shows the interconnectedness of every German citizen. And there's a great scene, I think, in the sort of towards the beginning of the book where one of the postcards is left at a doctor's office, and the doctor, who of course turns it in immediately to the police, the postcard, he's worried though, because he's been forced to divorce his wife, who is Jewish, and then he rehired her with false papers as his housekeeper. So she's got legal papers, but it's still his wife. But he's afraid that the Gestapo will find out about this. Everyone – and that there's a refrain throughout. Everyone in Germany has something to hide.
And everyone's fearful all the time in this book. It's true. Really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, you think, how did they do it? And oh, go ahead. Yeah.
The title is Every Man Dies Alone. The author is Hans Vlott. We're going to talk about some happy books too, but this was a very, very important book, and I'm glad we brought it up. And Cassie Rose, you were the one who gave us that title
last time,
and thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We're going to take a one-minute break and then welcome your calls to 292-8513. Back in a minute.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
I think we're really benefiting from that staycation mentality.
At the Columbus Zoo, ranked number one in the nation by One Travel Guide, attendance is up about 30% so far this year.
Normally in a downturn in the economy, zoos and local attractions like zoos do very well.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And you're listening to All Sides Weekend on WOSU 820 NPR News. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1020 this morning. Some sunshine today, but also a chance of showers and thunderstorms, a high of 75. Rain likely tonight, a low of 38 degrees. Sunshine for Saturday and much cooler, a high of 53. Partly sunny on Sunday and a high of 55. All Sides Weekend continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
We are back. I'm Christopher Purdy here on Talking About Books with Donald Ray Pollack, Cassie Rose, and Bill Eichenberger. All of these three wonderful people have blogs, they have websites, etc., and all of that can be accessed through wosu.org/allsides. So I don't have to give you 10 or 11 addresses, but they are all well worth a visit and greatly enjoyable. Cassie Rose, during the break, I looked at you and said, my goodness, give us a funny book to talk about. And what's with Abraham Lincoln and the vampires? It's in the news a lot. I mean, I'm reading a lot of reviews about this book, and you do have it here. So.
And it is on the bestseller list, okay. And I am reading it. I'm okay. Halfway through it, and I have to admit there was some arm twisting that came with it for the reading because I was bashing zombies on my blog and saying that, you know, I didn't like them marching through the classics. And someone responded. A man named Tom Foolery, and who basically wrote to me and said, lighten up.
Yeah, lighten up, yeah.
So that was last fall, and then I was writing again and saying, my gosh, the zombies are still lurching down. You know? And I brought up not zombies, but the vampires are now with Abraham Lincoln, and he said, well, are you going to read it? And I said, okay, I'll bite. And so I've got the book, and I have to admit, it's entertaining. I'm halfway through it, and it's a light read. It's great coming on the heels of having read Matterhorn, which I can talk about later.
Yes.
But I'm enjoying it, and I think part of the enjoyment, though, is the history. Because what he does, it's like you go on, you get the history and say, okay, Abraham Lincoln's grandfather was working in the fields, and the Indians came, and they killed him, and you get all this, and then a couple pages, but it was really a vampire that did it. And then he weaves that in. And then you read about the death of his mother and his aunt and uncle, and you get all that history, and then, but it was really a vampire, and he connects that. And so then it was some slaves that were trying to get away from their plantation, and they were jumping on his boat, but they were really running from a vampire. So
let me just
be very clever
before you go on, because people are going to ask, give me the full title and the author.
It's Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and it's by Seth Graham Smith, who also wrote the bestseller Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Well, Seth certainly has an interesting look at life or obsession, if we not.
He does.
It's working for him, clearly.
He does. But, you know, and that's part of, I think, what bothers me or unsettles me is that someone takes a classic novel that's part of the public domain. Now, that's not true of this, but that's what he did with Pride and Prejudice, and he just, you know, mashes it up and gets on the bestseller list and makes a lot of money. Now, the difference is he's writing original novel here with the vampire hunter, Abraham Lincoln. So that's his own creativity. But there's something about going back and mashing up these classics that, I don't know,
well,
bothers me.
Yeah, it's working for a number of people, I was glad to see that. 292-8513 is our number. We'd like to have you call in and recommend books that you've liked or not liked, or let us know that you're out there listening and appreciating books with Cassie Rose, Bill Eichenberger, and Donald Ray Pollack. What is Quicksand?
Quicksand. It's not lighter, funny.
Well,
is that
make
right?
It lighter. No, yeah, that's fine. No, that by all means.
Or we could talk about Simon Tolkien.
Yeah, do that. Okay.
Which reminds me of a funny writer.
All right.
How's that?
Good.
Because he's J.R. Tolkien's grandson, but he's really he's the literary
heir yes.
of John Mortimer's Rumpel o' the Bailey series. That's kind of it's a murder mystery set. You know, through the trial at the Old Bailey and crusty, unfair judges and canny noble defense attorneys and that kind of thing. And it's a pretty good story about an atrocity that happens at the end of World War II. 13 years later, an Oxford don is murdered in his study, and who did it? He was going to write his son out of the will. That's hence the title, The Inheritance. And he's really terrific at character development, and again at building sort of brick by brick this sense of that you're in England and in London in the 1950s.
So his gift for place is important.
Yeah,
he gets it.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And he takes you back about 50 years. So it's just after the war. Rationing is just over.
It's
still a little gray, but yeah, okay. Yeah. This is Simon Tolkien is the grandson, you said, of the man who wrote The Hobbit and
J.R. Tolkien. That's right. It's his third novel, but it's only his second novel that's been published. His first one, he said, is unpublishable, but it was a first shot. And he was a barrister for his entire career. And when he turned 40, much like Donald Todd, he wanted to do something else besides lawyer for a while. And he finally got up the courage, you know, having been J.R. Tolkien's grandson, I think it put him off for a long time.
He finally
took the plunge and is starting to have a successful career, especially in England, but also here.
Our number to call is 292-8513. You can also send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Donald, do you read as a preparation to write or to complement your own writing? Is it important to read other people's work? And if so, what is particularly interesting for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, for one thing, I don't think if you don't love to read, I doubt if you're ever going to be a writer, you know, really what it comes down to. So, yeah, I read a lot. I'm a very slow reader. I might pay a little bit too much attention. Lately, I've been reading a lot of older stuff. I just finished Paul Johnson's A History of Christianity, for that matter. But now, a couple books that I would like to mention real quick.
Good.
There's a book of stories, won the Mary McCarthy Award in 2008. The collection's called Drowned Boy by Jerry Gabriel. And all the stories are set in Moraine, Ohio, which is a little town, I believe, on the other side of Dayton. And it's a really good book. It's a good book. There's a book that hasn't come out yet, and it's being published by a small press in California called World Parade. And I blurbed this book, and it's coming out this summer, and it's called Please Don't Shoot Anyone Tonight by a guy named Dave Newman.
That's a great title.
And it's set in a small town in Pennsylvania, these two teenagers who are concocting this crime spree that never really does come off. But anyway, it's a good book.
Did the author send you the book to blurb it, or did the press? Do you remember?
In this case, the press emailed me and asked me if I'd, you know, endorse the book.
And how do you make that decision? Do you say, well, I'll read the book and then say what, or do you?
Yeah.
Do you?
Well,
I mean, how does that work?
Because you can say no, right? Or you can say, I didn't like this book, therefore
well,
I'm not going to.
Yeah, you just, you know, I tell them, well, yeah, I'll take a look at it. And it was a really good book. And I've been really lucky. I mean, the books that I have, you know, in blurbed or whatever, they've all been pretty decent. And
are they all along the theme of Nockham Stiff? So has anyone sent you a romance to I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Did they pick up what Nockham Stiff?
I think that for the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
so
how it happens. And then, you know, like people just that I know and stuff like that. But, yeah, I mean, most of them are probably along the same lines, that same sort of grittiness and whatever. Mm-hmm. Another book I'm reading, though, I just started reading it. I'm only halfway through, and it's an older book. I think it came out in the 70s. And it's a novel called A Way of Life Like Any Other by a guy named Darcy O'Brien.
Bill, you're nodding. You
I just heard of it, yeah.
It's a really good book, and it's funny. And this Darcy O'Brien, his parents were silent movie stars in Hollywood. And so then the novel is very autobiographical. It, you know, describes his parents' breakup and stuff like that. But he does it in a really funny way. And it's also pretty touching, too, the way that he does it.
We have an email from Vicky who says she came across the Traitor to the Crown series a few months ago and really liked them. They were fun fantasy reads. Patriot Witch, A Spell for the Revolution, and Demon Redcoat. Me being from Lexington, Massachusetts, I think that might be interesting for me. So thank you very much, Vicky, for that recommendation. And we have a call on the line. We have Lynette with a recommendation for us. Hello, Lynette, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I'd like to recommend the book Driftless, Driftless, and it's by David Rhodes, Rhodes.
Tell us about it. Why are you recommending it?
Well, I found the title looking for an 80th birthday present for my father in Iowa, and in Iowa they have a program called Iowa Reads, in which a book is recommended for the year, and everyone is to read it, and then there are community discussions. And so I read it, and it's just exceptional. Wonderful characters, interesting plot.
Driftless by David Rhodes.
Yes.
So would you recommend others of his books as well?
Well, it's interesting. He graduated from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1971 and quickly published three books in 72, 74, and 75, and then was paralyzed in a motorcycle accident in 1977, and this is his first book since that time.
His comeback. That's not a great story, but that's a very compelling story, certainly.
Yes. Yeah. The title refers to an area in northeastern Iowa and southwestern Wisconsin, which was left untouched by the glaciers. And so it's very hilly and so forth. And there's a parallel drawn between the characters in the novel who are in some ways untouched by time.
That's Driftless by David Rhodes. Thank you so much, Lynette, for that recommendation. Thank you. And we have Michael on the line calling about the Grandview Library. Hello, Michael.
Yes, good morning to you. Just calling. I'm the chair of the Grandview Library Levy, and asking the people of Grandview and Marble Cliff to vote yes on May 4th for Issue 5. This is going to help us quite a bit because the state, as you might know, has cut back drastically on all libraries in Ohio. And we're just asking people to vote yes. The expenses have already been dramatically cut for the Grandview Library, and we don't want to cut any more. Hours and staff and services and programs, things like that. So if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, we're very happy to have the call. I'm happy to support the libraries everywhere because one of the reasons that a lot of people come to Columbus in this area is that this area is known for outstanding public library service, and I'm sorry if they are being curtailed for budgetary reasons. Everybody's feeling it these days, no matter where you are. We do thank you for that call, and we're going to go on now and talk more about books because you, Cassie Rose, brought up Matterhorn, which is another big book you have with you.
Yes, we talked about Matterhorn, in February it was, because I saw it in the forecasts, and I've now read it, and I can say that it's all that I hoped it would be. It is riveting, and it's astonishing in what he accomplishes in this book. It's 1969 Vietnam, and pretty much I think what it sets it apart from so many Vietnam novels, and I've read Tim O'Brien and Philip Caputo and Larry Heineman. And certainly, and this is going to go into that canon, I believe, as a classic, because you feel like you're embedded with Bravo Company that goes into the bush, the combat Marines. He focuses on the second lieutenant named Mellis, and he's out of Princeton, so he arrives in Vietnam very well schooled but inexperienced, and his hesitancy in the beginning is palpable. And as you feel embedded with these characters, and I say that because you don't end up caring about them. You feel like you're standing beside them as you go through the novel. And then more and more, they don't become characters to you. And that's why I couldn't put this book down. Also, I think that he is brilliant in creating that ridiculous unfairness of the upper brass and Washington that were pushing these kids. And that's another thing.
Kids.
You get in the middle of the book and you realize these are 18 and 19-year-olds. Yeah. And they were pushed in this story, in the combat scenes with, you know, low on supplies, no food, thirsty, and the colonel, who's an alcoholic, is pushing them because he gets high on success and on the body counts of the North Vietnamese. It is a stunning book. And he also is very good in creating the tension between how the soldiers realize what the colonel is all about and the tension between the white and the African-American soldiers. And so you just can't help but to keep walking with these Marines. He ends it brilliantly, too. It's perfect.
The book is set in 1969, but it was written recently. Is that...
Well, he has been writing it over 30 years,
wow.
And he received a lot of rejections for it. Originally, it was about 1,600 pages, and of course, you know, agents and publishers will recoil at that. But there was a small press in California, El Leon Literary Arts, that recognized the greatness in this book and was publishing it, going down that path, and a staff at Barnes & Noble were reading it. I don't know why he submitted it to them. But they then gave it to or called up the New York publishers and said, you need to look at this book. So it's published in a partnership of a small press, El Leon, and also Grove Atlantic Press.
The author's name again, please.
It's Carl Marlantes, and he is a veteran combat Marine. And so he was there and has been writing it for 30 years.
The title is Matterhorn. That's going to go to top of my list right now, just based on the compelling way which you described that for us. 292-8513. See how great it is to get a recommendation of a book. So if you have one or if you'd like to hear more, 292-8513, or send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. I'm Christopher Purdy with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Donald Ray Pollack. If you go to wosu.org/allsides, you can find links to the blogs and works of all of these three terrific people. And we're going to be talking about books shortly, but right now a break for a little bit. Stay tuned, and we'll be back in 90 seconds.
Of the next Fresh Air, singer Catherine Russell.
Maybe I can't live to love you as long as I want to.
Russell has a new CD, the third under her own name. She spent years as a backup singer for performers like Paul Simon, David Bowie, and Cyndi Lauper. Her father was Louis Armstrong's music director during much of the 30s and early 40s. Join us.
Things like I want to.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Tune into WOSU TV tonight at 9:30 for Columbus on the Record. Mike Thompson and his panel will discuss Governor Strickland's appointment of Eric Brown as Ohio Supreme Court Justice. They'll also discuss Ohio Tea Parties and passenger rail. That's on Columbus on the Record tonight at 9:30. It's on WOSU TV. Be sure to subscribe to podcasts of Arts Unscripted and reviews of the latest books, movies, local restaurants, and theater performances. You can podcast stories from WOSU Arts and Culture contributors online at wosu.org/podcasts. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine today, but mostly cloudy, and a good chance of rain showers and thunderstorms, a high of 75 this afternoon. Rain this evening and a low of 38 degrees tonight. Some sunshine and much colder for Saturday, a high of 53. Partly sunny on Sunday and a high of 55. All Sides Weekend continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Christopher Purdy, back talking about books with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Donald Ray Pollack. I'm delighted to remind everybody that Donald is the recent recipient of an Ohio Arts Council Individual Excellence Award. His collection of short stories, Knock'em Stiff, knocked it out of the park, as I said earlier, a couple of years ago, and he has a new novel almost ready to go. He also, in the last couple of years, found the time to get an MFA at Ohio State. The busy Donald Ray Pollack took time to be with us today for the first time on this program. Thank you again for being here.
Thanks.
Now, Bill Eichenberger has brought us a beautiful book about conservation. We've been talking about silly books. We've been talking about Kitty Kelly. We've been talking about Nazi Germany. Let's talk about something beautiful right now.
Well, and if you like atlases or maps, this is a good good one for the most modern and up-to-date kind of things. It's called the Atlas of Global Conservation, Changes, Challenges, and Opportunities to Make a Difference. That sounds a little dry, but inside it's really, really fascinating, and it's very well illustrated as well. The idea being that for the first time with the advances in satellite technology, we can really see our own impact on the Earth from outer space. And we come back with these remarkable, remarkable images, and they're also kind of warning signs that they have a whole section of maps showing sequential maps of like over the last 10, 15, 20 years of, oh, you see little pockets of human activity in a certain area, wild region, and then 10 years later you see that, that those pockets are now becoming linked. And then 20 years later you see that it's all human activity and the wilderness is completely gone. And so it's kind of a guide of the places that are most wild and worth preserving for future generations. And then just a beautiful book to look at. It's filled with science and impassioned essays by a whole series of scientists and writers. And
it's timely right now as volcanoes have shut down Europe pretty much completely with that. And I can think of myself, a couple of people for whom that would be a wonderful gift. So I do thank you for that.
Yeah, it's put out by the Nature Conservancy.
Yeah, that's a wonderful recommendation. Thank you. We have a couple of emails coming in. We'd like a listener wants to know the opinion of our panel on two books, Solar by Ian McEwan and The Infinities by John Banville. Is this resonating with anybody?
I know of them, but I haven't read them.
She or he was a bit disappointed, but thinks that these books may have been overhyped. So now that we've ruined the careers of these two authors.
Well, I've heard that about the Ian McEwan book for Solar. I mean, one review I think I read said that it was better than Chesil Beach. Terms of his career and what he writes about. But still, I guess he's not performing up to what people are expecting.
We have an email from Todd, who I think has been listening very carefully and may have been eavesdropping, because he wants to know about guilty pleasures among our panelists in our books. He especially likes Mario Acevedo writing gritty vampire private eye fiction. So I'm going to put all of you on the spot for guilty pleasure books. We'll start with you, Bill. And why should we feel guilty anyway?
That's right. I've already explained my theory on that. If you read a 500-page book about Nazi Germany, you're allowed to read Kitty Kelly.
Yes, you are.
You've earned it.
Yes.
I mentioned him earlier. Probably John Mortimer would be a guilty pleasure, the Rumpel stories.
That's British. That's still pretty high rent. I mean, that's true.
Even if it's British, though, you're right. You're right. Well, in which case, if I had to pick some, maybe the older that's British, too. I was going to say Ken Follett. I'm trying to think.
I'm talking about Jacqueline Suzanne. I mean, come on. I want to get down.
That guilty.
In fact, that's a great question. Let me throw that out there. 292-8513. Let's talk about guilty pleasures and have some real fun. Let's get down with this. 292-8513. Cassie Rose, any guilty pleasures for you?
Don't say
the dictionary or something.
No, I don't have a consistent one. But, I mean, I read Diana, Tina Brown's book.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like that a lot.
Wasn't that a wonderful? Yes. Well, it was very well written. But still, it was, years ago, and I brought it onto the show here, and it was Freddie Andrews, was like rolling his eyes. I go, no, it's really good. It's really good.
She's a social historian, if you
yes,
don't mind. Come
yes.
on.
Yeah. So, as much as I've been ribbing you about the Kitty Kelly and all that, I would be likely to pick something up like that. So, that's where my guilty pleasure is, kind of the People magazine kind of a thing.
How about you, Donald? Do you have any guilty pleasures?
I have to confess, as long as, as far as reading goes, I really don't. You know, most of my guilty pleasures, I guess, would come from TV and films and stuff like music, stuff like that. So, and I just have this thing about, well, there's so many good books that I haven't read. I kind of keep my nose to the
ground. Every time you read a guilty pleasure is a lost opportunity to have read one of them. Yeah.
Right.
But I think that Bill's got the point, is that because you reach for that, especially after you've read either a couple long, you just need that lightness. Mm-hmm. It's going out for ice cream.
You need stupid. Stupid can be very good sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, how stupid is she? She's richer than any of us ever. Guilty pleasures and more, 292-8513. Send us an email to allsides at WOSU.org. Well, I'll tell you, I'm you know, I was a little bit embarrassed because I asked for a reserve at the library for the Oprah book by Kitty Kelly, and wasn't I like the second on the list, for goodness sake? I got it the second day it was published, and I did sneak it out. I mean, I checked it out, but I had it under my jacket. I didn't want any, I didn't want Cassie Rose to walk in and see me walking out of there with this book that I'm now reading. And I must say, it's really bad. It's a guilty pleasure. I mean,
well, when you say bad,
Dominic
is it
Dunn, she's not. We'll put it that way.
Well, is it bad writing or
no,
is it?
No, it's I mean, you know, there's a great character in it because she spends a lot of time with the man who raised Oprah Winfrey and gave her his name, who apparently is not her biological father, but he is her father figure, and he sounds like a very opinionated, grounded gentleman. I mean, you'd probably he's a barber in Memphis, and you'd probably want to sit and have coffee with this guy for 3 hours and be riveted. You know, he did march with Martin Luther King, and he had all kinds of things to say, and he's not approving of a lot of people in her life right now, or necessarily of her, and he is really sort of the he and a cousin of his, these two elderly people, are very, very – they have a lot to say. So. And I don't think they'll be having Thanksgiving at her house anytime soon. 292-8513. You want to talk about quicksand right now, Bill, and get us – elevate the tone a bit?
Are we done with guilty pleasures?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, you're all sort of – I mean, I put it out there, and you're all being kind of coy about it. So.
Quicksand is subtitled America's Pursuit of Power in the Middle East by Jeffrey Warrow. And I just think it's a fascinating topic. I think power in the Middle East is a – what would you call it? What is something? Quixotic? I think that
– definitive. I mean, dangerous.
Yes, and I was just reading where and it was under the heading of one of the writers that I like said a file under the heading of something that shouldn't take 5 years to figure out. And the U.S. troops had moved out of a particular area of Afghanistan where they had been for 5 years because they had figured out after 5 years that they were in the, basically human fodder in the middle of warlords fighting it out amongst themselves. And so they withdrew from this area, and it's like, wow, that took 5 years to figure out. And so, but it's a really interesting look so far. I'm not completely finished with it yet, but about our history of presence and our quest for power.
We talk about timely. That's been timely for many, many years now, and I suspect will be for a while longer.
Yeah.
So thank
you
for that. We have two email recommendations. David Bianculli, who NPR listeners will know, has written a book called Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Cassie Rose is not old enough to remember the Smothers Brothers, but the rest of us are.
I am, yes.
I actually read that book and thought it was terrific. I liked it very much. And I learned a lot from it that I didn't really – I wasn't really sure why the Smothers Brothers were always considered very controversial. But when you get back in, they were very anti-Vietnam. They were very, very outspoken in the context of a 40-year-old comedy show.
Frequently censored, weren't
they? They were indeed. Yeah. In fact, yeah. And Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. This has been in the news lately. It's very much different than the Smothers Brothers book. As I understand it, do you know about this book, the Henrietta – Cassie, could you?
I've not read it, but,
she's.
I've read a lot about it. In fact, I got to the point, and I own the book. It's on my table, but I've read so much about it that I felt like I had seen too many trailers, you could say, so I almost knew the book. But it's about, an African-American woman who went into Johns Hopkins Hospital, and the physicians and the researchers took her cells, the HeLa cells, and from that a lot of medicine and vaccines of all have been produced. And so Rebecca Skloot researched this, and it was something she was interested in when she was a teenager from her science class, and spent, I think, about 10 years researching ferociously on the book, and has written a science book that's very accessible. It's become very popular. She's toured all over the United States.
She was here, Ms. Skloot,
yes,
with Ann Fisher a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, she was.
And Henrietta Lacks apparently benefited in no way from
Correct.
Any of this. I mean, she was basically used by the medical profession, although her DNA helped how many mm-hmm. millions of people over the years. I don't know if she's still living or not.
No, she's not, but her daughter is. And, of course, when Rebecca Skloot was approaching them, their first reaction was resistance because they thought, okay, one more person wants to take something from us and to use us. And it took her a while to get them to realize she was working with them and for them.
The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, that's another – sounds like a very worthwhile read by Rebecca Skloot. I'll put that on my list as well. You mentioned, Cassie, you had a lighter book for us too with a pithy black and pink cover. Let's lighten it up a little bit.
Well, it's called The People Who Watched Her Pass by Scott Bradfield. And, Don, you know his work, Scott Bradfield's work.
It's been quite a while, but I know I've read a book of stories by him and another mm-hmm. one called maybe The History of Luminous Motion.
Or yeah, there's something like that. This is published by $2 Radio, which is our Granville
Oh, of course. You put that on your blog, didn't you?
Yes. And it's $2 Radio. I love their Books Too Loud to Ignore is one. Anyway, they are producing some phenomenal books. And this one and Bradfield's work is – It's hard to describe. It's a novel, but really it's social commentary, and it is on the aftertaste and the after reading that I have appreciated this more. I don't underline in books, I don't mark them, but I got a couple pages into this and it was so overwhelmingly funny, pithy, to the point, I grabbed a pencil and underlined my way through it. He uses a 3-year-old little girl to be the lens onto life, and she is taken by the water heater repairman from her parents. So you think, oh, abduction story, and it's not at all, because he basically says, you know, I want to get you because you are pure and looking at life, and I want to see what you see. I know you're grimacing here. It's very funny.
I'm a little creeped out by
it. Then she sets off and is wandering into – it's very much a metaphor. I mean, one of the scenes, she's talking to a coyote in the desert, so it puts it on that level. But his points that he makes, for example, she loves to – she wanders away from this guy, and she lives in laundromats. And again, this doesn't sound happy, but it's more commentary. And she's 4 years old and meets a clerk next door who wants to marry her. And she's like, oh, come on, I'm 4 years old. And he's like, oh, no, but yeah, he's like that. He says, get over it. We can adjust to each other. I want you to just adjust to my lifestyle. So the commentary on marriage is hilarious. But it's a book that you have to – you more so appreciate on the end, because you look back over, and what he is saying is that we all come into this world unique and pure, and we face a lot of conformity, and we're sort of pressed out of our –
just hope we don't get arrested reading it.
No. I know that – you get on the first page, but you know immediately by his language that it's humorous and insightful, and he's a good writer.
Donald, you know, I'm very curious to ask you, you said you entered the profession of writing later in life. Is the profession as it is, in fact, you deal with agents, you deal with publishers, you deal with all kinds of people to whom you basically have to give your work over to, is that what you expected or not? Were you surprised in any way when you went from somebody who was just writing for yourself to somebody who was adopting it as a profession?
Well, I had read a lot of biographies, you know, of writers. And so I guess I sort of knew, you know, some of the, you know, a little bit about it, not much. And, you know, for me, it's been, you know, I've been very lucky, you know. But I know a lot of people who are better writers than I am, who are still struggling to find somebody who will publish, you know, their first book, that sort of thing. And then, you know, I think the climate has changed a lot, you know, as far as the business goes. And then, too, I think that a lot of times the big publishers are looking for you to have some sort of a you got something in your background or your personality or whatever that can help sell the book, which, you know, in the old days that didn't matter so much.
But you have that because
And I had that. And so, you know, and I don't think that's what people should be looking at.
I did a story once, or an interview with Nathan Englander, and I was doing a little research about him, and 8 or 9 stories in a row that I read about him began with description of his hair.
Yeah.
And how good-looking he was.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's their peg, you know?
Right.
It has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, it shouldn't at all, but it does. You know, I mean, it's just the way that our society is now, you know, with...
Do you have a sense now whether talent will out, or do you feel that maybe, like you said, a better writer than yourself will go unpublished and into the oblivion?
Yeah.
Or do you think eventually
those writers will find
a home?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them do.
So there's no ideal world where eventually the talent finally rises to the top?
Well, I think most writers are either going to write because they absolutely can't stop and they love it,
mm-hmm.
or they hold out that hope that eventually, you know, they're going to get published. And, you know, I think if it's only, you know, you're writing because you're holding out that hope, you know, that it's going to happen someday, if a lot of them, you know, you give up.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it reminds me a bit of somebody that we've talked about before, one of my favorites, Don Powell.
Mm-hmm.
Don Powell, who was an Ohio mm-hmm. writer who died 45 years ago and basically homeless and forgotten.
And penniless.
I don't think her title sold more than 5,000 a copy in her lifetime,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
then she was rediscovered and now she's a best-selling author. And by the way, you shouldn't miss her, Don Powell, if you're out there listening.
Yes, and I often think about her and her life because she did keep writing.
She did. She never stopped.
She never stopped because she – and it wasn't because, oh, maybe, but it was because it was the heart of her and the core of her. And if it's an inspiration, not just for a writer but for anyone, that she lived as she felt she was – what she was about. She lived her purpose. And even though, you know, I mean, Hemingway acclaimed her – and other, you know, best-selling authors during the time were saying she's wonderful, but she couldn't sell. But she kept writing and believing in herself, as did her editors and her publishers. But yet, you're right, she died penniless.
And she can be very dear and very biting and very
mm-hmm.
funny.
Yes.
I mean, she's a wonderful. We also have a recommendation from Gail. Hello, Goodbye by Emily Chenoweth. Emily Chenoweth was from Delaware. She now lives in Portland, Oregon. It's a combination fiction, nonfiction novel about a family dealing with the impending loss of the mother. And Gail tells us that this book is a must. Hello, Goodbye by Emily Chenoweth. Anybody have any?
I read about it in Publishers Weekly. It came out, I think, a year ago, and it's her debut. So she was profiled as, you know, a first novelist.
How do each of you find what you want to read? Because I know Donald's asked to blurb things. You all probably get a lot of unsolicited books in the mail
mm-hmm.
and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that makes you want to pick the book up, that if you've never heard of it, is cover art that important? I mean, that's compelling to a lot of people. Is it, especially if it's a writer you've never heard of?
I can speak to Matterhorn about that. I mean, there was a letter from the publisher, a full-page ad in Publishers Weekly, and something about it just hit me. And I think part of it is just over the years of constantly scouring all the publications, London publications, U.S. publications, hearing things, ear to the ground. It's a gut instinct that gets developed in terms of what I need to pick up, what I need to grab. The $2 radio books that come out, one thing that first, it's who blurbs them. I mean, Jonathan Lethem is blurbed on this book, The People Who Watched Her Pass By. You know, and I was like, okay, we're out in Granville, Ohio. What's going on here and with this press? So it's not one or two things. It's a combination of things over time that hone, I think, my gut instinct.
Are you enjoying your blogs? The Book Surfed, which is Bill Eichenberg's blog, and The
yeah.
Longest Chapter, which is Cassie's blog?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's what I want to do. It's the most fun I've had in the last year has been talking to authors again and getting hooked back up with, mm-hmm. you know, reading and getting to talk to authors.
So. We have a minute left. Let me use that to make the point that you can access all of the blogs and websites of my three guests today through wosu.org/allsides. They are all worth regular visits. I do want to thank Donald Ray Pollack for making the trip today to join us. Thank you so much for that.
I appreciate it.
Did Nockham Stiff get their sign back yet, or is it still missing?
Oh, that's right.
No, they've never gotten a new one anyway. So.
And we'll look forward to your new novel. I know you're sort of in the woodshedding period now when you have to deal with the business aspect of that, which can or cannot be pleasant. But I wish you well with that. And come back and talk to us about that in a few months.
All right. I hope so.
Cassie Rose, thank you as always for being the adult and the touch of class.
Thank you, Christopher.
Thank you very much. And
thanks,
Bill Eichenberger, my buddy with his great Bruce Springsteen T-shirt. I thank you all. This is Listener Supported, WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News. Thank you.